all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Southern Remedy, where the doctor is always in. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, professor of pediatrics and internal medicine at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. We'll be taking questions about your health or the health of a loved one, questions about prescriptions or medications, or questions about a recent visit to your doctor's office. And we'll be sharing some of the latest healthcare news.
Really good weather we've been having. We've been spoiled in central Mississippi here. It really has been nice. A little cooler nights. I really love that. I wish it could just be like this for a large portion of the year. Maybe we could just skip the 100 degree, 90% humidity months in lieu of this. It would be nice, wouldn't it? But I hope you're enjoying yourself and getting out there and getting some physical activity. It's always good. I intentionally, people ask me from time to time to say, they say, hey, you're a doctor. What do to like increase physical activity? And while I do have some time set aside to do that throughout the week, that I try to make a priority. It doesn't always happen, but I try to make a priority with that. Even, walking back and forth, UMMC is a fairly centralized large campus, but it's pretty easy to walk. And instead of walking in a covered fluorescent or now, I guess, LED lit hallway, I prefer to go outside, particularly on days like this, and just to get a little sunlight, to walk outside across the campus, smell that breeze and all the other pollen. So I pay for it with my allergies, but I think it's worthwhile overall. So I encourage you to do that. Look for ways you can do that and get a little bit more physical activity in your day, particularly on when the weather is so nice like this. We have a lot of parents that bring their kids in for physicals, and this is one of those times of you can pretty much sort of predict the times of year that they do this. So there's a lot of training things that happen as school years wind down. Of course, with a lot of our school districts now having continuous throughout the year schools with those breaks in between, it sort of changes some of these things. But a lot of people would say, well, why do we have a school sports physical? What is the purpose of that? And the purpose is really to see if it's appropriate with different medical conditions, which activities, both in the participation in training and in the actual sports activity, which one of those might cause some problems. Or if they're still able to participate, what kind of limitations or precautions do they need to take? One that comes up often is asthma. And asthma, affects the lungs. It's basically a obstructive lung disease, a reversible obstructive lung disease. That just means that there is a spasm of the muscles and a contraction of the muscles around the airways such that you reduce airflow. It's usually triggered by an external event. Sometimes that can be triggered by things like exercise. But that doesn't need to prevent you from participating. You certainly want to get your doctor's okay with that. There might be some individual reasons why that wouldn't be, or certain sports that might be a little more dangerous. But there's things that you can do before that. A lot of athletes will, or anybody participating in sports may, before a sports activity, if they do have particularly exercise-induced asthma, you just might need to have an inhaler handy to use that before you do that event. So things like that, that's always something that we love to, just say, hey, this is the way you should do this. And we don't really exclude a whole lot of people. There certainly are some conditions that we might exclude from certain sports. If you only have one kidney, probably not a good idea to have impact sports because you don't have a spare. So things like that. But there's very particular things, and maybe some things. I've actually done some sports physicals where the questions came up about from the history, like the family history, that actually had not come up before So we were able to sort of dive into that, like risk of heart disease or risk of stroke and what we needed to do differently. And then you can give sort of a soft handoff to schools, particularly if they have trainers that are available for different sports, and they can help condition those young athletes as they're participating to try to minimize any type of injury and allow them to compete later on. So just a couple of things like that. That's the sort of the reasons why your kid may look fine. You're like, why do we have to go in and get this done? There really are some specific things that we look for on the history and the physical exam, and in some cases some labs, but usually not, or other tests. But that can help them do their best in prevent some of those injuries or complications that might happen. Let's go to C. Young. Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Good. What's your question today?
I have a question concerning high blood pressure.
Sure.
Are there any foods and quick ways to lower high blood pressure?
Yeah. Did you say foods? Is that what you said?
Food or minerals.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Food that you can eat or minerals that you can take that can lower your blood pressure quickly. And for a pre-diabetic, are there any foods or minerals that can be taken for that as well?
Yeah. Yeah, let's answer the hypertension one first. So, you know, we know a lot about how food affects certain chronic conditions. And number one, if you've been diagnosed with hypertension, that's probably something that you're going to deal with the rest of your life in some way, form, or fashion. And it may require medications. Most people do. But what you eat and your exercise patterns and maybe getting rid of some bad habits if you have them, like smoking and those kinds of things, can help lower the blood pressure. I do have some patients that are controlling their blood pressure solely with diet and exercise. Now, what we love to do is we love to tease out certain things and say, well, selenium or chromium or potassium supplements or those kinds of things. Every time we've done a study to try to figure out those types of interventions where we give a group of people who have hypertension supplements in any one or a combination of those, it doesn't work in lowering blood pressure. What does work is certain types of foods in a diet that is healthy for you, like particularly the one that's been the most studied is called the DASH diet, D-A-S-H, that stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. For more than, probably 30 years now, we've been looking at this diet, which comes from a Mediterranean diet. So it's a diet that is rich in fruits and vegetables. Fresher is better. It's not a whole lot of red meat. The protein sources tend to be either plant-based or from fish or chicken. And the fat sources come from oils and not solid fats like butter or lard. It comes from mainly olive oils and other plant-based oils and nuts. And if you eat a meal that is rich in that, in the intervention trials, the DASH trials in all age groups, it's a very healthy diet. It's not really what I would call a fad diet. It's something that can be healthy in lots of different ways. Your blood pressure will come down about 8 to 14 points. That's a lot. That's about as much as any one medication. Incidentally, if you're on a blood pressure medication already, it may work better while you're eating this diet because they actually work together. And the thought process is there is some substances in these foods that will improve blood pressure. And by avoiding things like fast food, fried foods, processed foods, foods that are high in salt, that also will lower blood pressure. So that's been definitely proven, but I do still have patients come in all the time and they say, yeah, but what can I just get the same thing in a supplement? You really can't. We haven't been able to prove that yet in anything. And I think probably you're wasting your time with those. They're probably not going to hurt you, but it's not an insignificant amount that people pay for that. Now, for diabetes, we used to, a long time ago, have a diabetic diet. I'm making air quotes with that, too. Diabetic diet, right? And it was only certain foods you could eat. We now know that you can have a lot of different foods that you eat. And it's about the types of foods, the foods that you mix together, and the foods that have a that release their sugars, their carbohydrates quicker. So really, you could sit down with that DASH diet, and you probably are going to be just fine as long as you're having, because the DASH diet does have a lot of foods that release their sugars. It's called the glycemic index, a lower glycemic index, and then it's not going to spike your blood sugar really quickly. And they have a lot of fiber in them, which also is a very healthy pre-diabetic type diet to eat. And if you combined that DASH diet with what you just mentioned, the hypertension and the prediabetes, along with regular exercise, exercise is very useful in both of those conditions to lowering your blood sugar, lowering your blood pressure, but it's really useful with a prediabetic state and diabetes. Like, it is very powerful. And what that looks like is something as simple as walking 5 days a week, working up to 30 minutes at a time, while you're breathing fast enough to where you can still talk but not sing. That's an easy way to think about it. And then if you can throw in some light weights or some resistance training, maybe 1 to 2 times a week, that's even better from a diabetic standpoint. That's just as powerful as one of the entry-level medications that we oftentimes use called metformin. And that was a trial going back to the mid to late 90s on that.
Okay.
So look up the DASH diet. I think that would be a good place to start. Also, look on the American Diabetic Association's website. They've got a great section in there about the foods that would be good for you to eat in a pre-diabetic state. Sometimes the way things work here in the studio, and I've been trained. They're still training me. I don't think it's ever going to end because I don't take the directions, and it's such a fascinating world here at MPB Studios, and they're incredible people who are dedicated and very competent in what they do, and they had to put up with me and all my incompetencies, I guess. But one of the things that sometimes we'll have a caller that calls in and for whatever reason sort of gets cut off. So we had one previously that was talking about antibiotic side effects. And I'm not sure what the specifics were, but I can talk a little bit about that. You know, antibiotics, when we say antibiotics, we usually mean a drug, a substance that is prescribed to treat a bacterial infection. So it's not really for a viral infection. It doesn't work for viruses. Now, we do have antiviral medications, things like valacyclovir or acyclovir, and certainly our HIV medications are antiviral. So there's lots of antiviral medications out there in treatments. But when you say antibiotics, really it's about things that treat bacteria. And depending on what type of bacteria it is, if we know, sometimes we just have to make an educated guess. We don't really culture certain places. You know, we'd have to get very specific. You have to get the exact bacteria. But we know certain bacteria live in certain areas usually. So you have to know which bacteria you're treating, where you're treating it, because that can sort of dictate which antibiotics you're going to use. Some antibiotics don't get into certain spaces in the body antibiotics are. Those two things come into play, and then there's all kinds of other things like age and weight of the individual. Do they have any complications with their liver function or with their kidney function? So all those things, to how old they are. As we get older, we try to change those doses to make them more appropriate. So all that sort of goes into it, but you can still have some complications with those. And a common one are GI side effects. And that's a couple of reasons why that's the case. So the antibiotics that you take by mouth, they can be a little harsh on your stomach sometimes. Certain antibiotics are a little bit more notorious than others about that. So there's a direct effect on the GI tract. And then because they're killing bacteria, you want to absorb that into your system. But we have a ton of bacteria in our gut, and they are there for a reason. They're healthy bacteria that are helping us make certain substances, like vitamin K is probably the one that people have heard about the most. But there's lots of other things, and then we're still finding out all kinds of different substances that bacteria make. and they help to process a lot of the foods that we eat. So those kinds of things sort of play into it. Well, when you take an antibiotic, particularly if it's for a prolonged period of time, you sort of wipe out those bacteria and they have to repopulate themselves. They do that fairly quickly within a couple of weeks. But it can you know, sort of do that, and you can get the GI side effects of diarrhea or abdominal cramping. And then there's all kinds of other specific side effects with antibiotics. For instance, doxycycline, which is an antibiotic that's used to treat skin and soft tissue infections. Sometimes it can cause a sun sensitivity, so you don't want to go out in the sun. And if you're out in the sun with your job and you have to be out there, you really want to be covered up or wear sunscreen, because you can have a horrendous sunburn with that. So that's just one of the things that you have to keep in mind. So it's a good idea to ask your doctor about that. Ask your pharmacist about that. And a side effect is not necessarily an allergy either. A lot of people confuse those. So an allergy is a different type of reaction, like a rash, or a more serious one would be if you have swelling in your mouth or in your airways and have trouble swallowing or breathing. Those are allergic reactions. Side effects really have to do with how that antibiotic works. And just because you have a side effect doesn't mean you'll have it again with the same antibiotic. And it doesn't mean that you have to avoid that antibiotic forever. So there's some things you can do, like eating live yogurt if you're taking them, and those kinds of things that can help minimize those side effects. But yes, we do have side effects with those. And it's just because they're not, a lot of them aren't targeted to the point, we just don't have a lot of specificity with how we treat those. Let's go to Alice from Macomb. Good morning, Alice.
Good morning, Dr. Jimmy Stewart. I done called you about a lot of mine.
All right.
But now I got a new one.
What's a new one, Miss Alice?
I'm on Eliquis for blood thinner. I ended up in the hospital last Thursday. I thought I was having pneumonia. It was hurting so bad under there. And got a blood clot. You know, right up, I raised my breast up. It's right up there. I think it's about my lungs, or in my lungs or something.
Yeah.
Got blood clot. I just got out of hospital Saturday.
Yeah.
So I want to know more about what and what, because I don't want to take the wrong thing. I'm 76 now. I ain't ready to die.
Well, I'm glad you got checked out, Miss Allison. Yeah, so Eliquis is a blood thinner. It is one of the newer blood thinners. We used to have, you know, a very limited choice of those, and they were hard to take. They interacted with a lot of stuff. The most common one was Coumadin, or warfarin is another name for it. And that was one that which interfered. We had this, what we call the coagulation cascade, which is a bunch of substances in your body that act in a way that normally, if you get a clot, I mean, if you get a cut, like let's say you have a bad cut on your finger, those are the substances that activate to help plug that. And they interact with platelets and other factors in your body so that you don't bleed to death. Well,
I ain't doing nothing but cut myself or bump my toe.
That's right. That's right. So when you have the opposite thing happening, though, if your blood is clotting for different reasons, and that they probably are, you know, if they haven't teased that out to try to figure out why you had one to begin with. But when we have certain situations where we have blood clots inside the bloodstream, particularly if it's in a vein, or if it travels up to the lungs, that's it. Yeah, that's probably what happened. Then you have to be on a blood thinner for a certain period of time until that clot stabilizes or goes away. And sometimes they can stay there for a long time. Typically, it's at least 6 months, maybe 3 to 6 months of treatment for something like that, but it depends on the individual person. Now, Eliquis is a newer one that's easier to take, has less risk of bleeding when compared to things like Coumadin, and it has less interactions with other medications. So it gives you a more consistent, it thins your blood, but it doesn't thin it too much that, you know, is going to cause some other problems. That being said, a lot of people do have some bleeding, so you do have to be aware of things like that. Like you said, if you're, you know, you don't need to, if you cut yourself, you need to apply direct pressure to it because your blood's going to be a little bit thinner. You might bruise a little bit more if you hit the wall or hit something like your knee or so don't be surprised if you bruise a little bit more, you know, with that. But it is a great medication and really is pretty well tolerated, and it's something you can take orally. It's not, you know, for a while there we had some shots too that you could do every day, but that nobody likes to do that every day.
I can't eat nothing green. I can't eat no green nothing.
Do they have you on Coumadin or Warfarin too?
I'm just on Eliquis. I got out.
Yeah, usually that's not, usually you can eat pretty much what you want to. So you might want to check back with them about that. If you like greens, this particular way that this medication works doesn't interfere with that the way Coumadin or Warfarin does. So check with them about that. That might be a little bit different.
I called the hospital and talked to the nurse yesterday and asked her. And she said, nothing green, and please don't drink no orange juice.
Huh, okay. All right. Well, that's a little bit different, but you might want to, when you go back to the doctor, just ask them the same question. It sounds like you really like your orange juice and greens.
What you talking about? I got them in the freezer. I don't want to give it away. This physician told me that take 2 tablets by mouth twice daily for 6 days. Then take 1 tablet twice daily after the 6th day. And I think she said the 6th day is Friday. Then I take 2 Saturday morning, and I don't take now Saturday night. And I started the 1 on Sunday. I'm confused.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I know it's going to be a little bit confusing, but for those 6 days, you do take a higher dose those first 6 days, and then after that, you sort of cut back. So I would just pull those instructions out. Sometimes, because you're probably going to be taking that for a while, it might even be useful to have it in like a little pill box or something that so you can remember when to take it. That, if it were me, I would want that for myself. I can't even, it's hard for me to do that.
Oh, you talking about the little pill about the thing that daily, that 7 days a week.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. You got crazy, you done got me all crazy.
You can do it.
I'm going to do it because I want to live a little bit longer. Not a little bit longer. I want to live as long as the good Lord let me.
Yes, ma'am. There you go. Well, it sounds like you're doing the right thing right now. So, Miss Alice, you take care, and I hope nothing else comes up, but you keep taking that medication like they told you. And ask about those greens.
Okay, and then that other thing about what do it do, dissolve or melt or what?
So it's really just preventing other clots from forming around that clot. Now, sometimes it will be reabsorbed over time, but again, that's a weeks and months type of thing. It takes a long time for that to happen. And they're probably not going to, they may or may not follow up with a CT scan of your chest. Most of the time we don't. We just treat it for 3 to 6 months. And then if there's a clear reason why you had it, like you were maybe on a long car ride or some people who fly for long periods of time, they'll get a clot and then they'll get it. It'll travel up to their lungs. If it's something that they feel like that you're at risk for a clot moving forward, you might have to be on it, you know, permanently on the Eliquis. So it just sort of depends on your situation. But I'd ask them that question. I ask them when you go back to, hey, why do y'all think that I got this clot? That would be a great question to ask.
I go to my primary care on Friday.
There you go. I bet you're going to get some information then.
I'm writing it down, too.
All right, Alice. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling, and thank you for sharing your questions with us. Let's go to Bill from Memphis. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
What's your question this morning?
Does Flomax work its best after the first dosage, or do I need to let it build up in my system?
Yeah, great question. This is for prosthetic type issues.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So Flomax or Tamsulosin is a medication that's commonly used to treat what's called benign prostate hypertrophy. So this is a condition is, you know, every man who has a prostate, as you get older, it gets bigger. And it can impede the flow of urine out of your body, and it can cause a lot of excess urination just because you have what's called overflow incontinence, and you can have some other symptoms with it as well, keep you up at night. So Flomax can help to shrink that prosthetic tissue. That's the way the drug works, by blocking a receptor on there. And that's the perfect question to ask, and it's one that I don't think patients get a whole lot of guidance on this when they're prescribed it. It's not something that you're going to notice a difference from the first dose, and that is incredibly that would be incredibly rare. It's usually you have to take it for weeks and sometimes a couple of months before you see any type of improvement. And the reason is that prostate's slowly going to get smaller the longer you use it, but it's not a quick process. So I try to do that. I'm sure I have messed up and rushed into the conversation and not said that, but that's one thing to keep in mind, that if you're going to be put on Flomax for this, you need to understand this. You sort of need to let it, you know, have at least probably a month to see if it's working, and it may be a slow improvement after that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That's very helpful.
Yes, sir. Thank you for listening, and thank you for calling. We talked a little bit about antibiotic side effects earlier in the hour, and also mentioned some things about side effects of medications. Certainly, lots of medications can have interactions with other medications that you're taking. Sometimes it's always a good idea to read what those might be, particularly if it's a new medication that you're started on. A lot of those have interactions with over-the-counter medications. Alice had called in earlier talking about her Eliquis, which is a anti-coagulant or a blood thinner is another common name for it. And although it does not have the interactions that other medications have, like Coumadin, with what you eat, there's a little bit of concern. If you eat a lot of grapefruit, then you might need to cut that back, at least if you're taking Eliquis. But other than that, foods are okay, but there's a lot of supplements that do interact with that. So things like turmeric or ginkgo extract. I mean, there's lots of different herbal supplements that would not be good to take with certain medications. So don't forget to include those. Again, that's probably a good question for your physician or pharmacist to ask too. If they don't ask that, just say, hey, I'm taking this herbal supplement. Is it going to interact with this medication? And there's some handy-dandy little tools that we use to do that. I don't remember all of those. I always, you know, if somebody tells me what they're taking, I put it into a little app that I have on my phone, and it cross-references that with any medications that they may be taking. A lot of our electronic systems now, when you go to the doctor or you're in the hospital and you have that electronic health record, they do that same thing. So the key is, though, you need to tell your physician if you're taking some supplements or things like that over the counter, because, again, they can interact in some instances with medication. Just make sure you're telling them about everything. When we ask, hey, what medications are you taking? Most patients just think about the ones that are prescribed and not those that they take over the counter, but they're still medications. Let's talk for a minute about depression. You know, there's lots of things to do to prevent depression. As you get older, and particularly if you've been a caregiver of a spouse or someone in your family for long periods of time, and unfortunately that spouse has died, that significant other has died, keep in mind that's going to leave a big space in your life, not just emotionally from the relationship that you had with them, but also most people have been doing a lot of things for that person. And it is an exhausting job that they love doing, but it does, after that person's gone, it leaves a lot of time and space that sometimes we have problems as patients of really like navigating that space. And it, in addition to talking to someone, particularly your primary care physician, whoever you normally see for your medical care, bring those kinds of things up. I was meeting with one of my patients earlier this week, and we talked about this with the loss of her husband. And I usually ask questions like, tell me about your day. What are you doing? And then a key component of that, and that is incredibly important, is like, who are you interacting with? Tell me about the people that you're interacting with. And some of us, during times of loss, we are adjustment to different things. We withdraw, and that may be okay for a while, but you really need that social interaction. And it doesn't have to be every day. Even for introverts, you really need that in some kind of way. And that we know the social implications of that and the psychological implications are huge. If you don't have that interaction, it can actually make the situation worse. So I would encourage you to do that, to really be intentional about doing it and not just sort of wait around. We're going to go to Lee from Mobile. Good morning, Lee.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. What's your question this morning?
Well, I'm an 81-year-old male that has back trouble. I have stenosis and arthritis in my lower back. Mm-hmm. I've had physical therapy for about a month. I've had one epidural, and I've also had some needling in my leg to relieve the stress in the muscle. But I'm still continuing to have pain. In fact, it's kind of moved up into my lower back. And my real question is, what's your thoughts on surgery for stenosis?
Yeah, so spinal stenosis, let me just back up because it sounds like you know pretty much what you're dealing with, but just to share with other people. So that's typically that's where the canal, where our spinal cord travels down through the different bones in our back, the vertebrae. There's a little canal, a little space, and it goes from one vertebrae to the other. It's protected in that, and that space can be narrowed for any number of reasons. Usually it's from chronic arthritis and stressors to that area. So the bone sort of has these bony growths that constrict the spinal cord. When it does that, you usually have symptoms of pain, of loss of mobility because of that pain, and then also sometimes you can have loss of muscle function. There's also some other things that can happen at the same time. Sometimes those vertebrae, again, over time, because of osteoarthritis and other factors, they can sort of slide back and forth on one another. So the position of them can change, and they're not sort of lined up. Sort of like if you were stacking blocks together and got them off, you know, if they're not exactly on top of each other the way they're designed and they were shifted a little bit, it places some strain on the spinal cord. So you mentioned, Lee, you know, several things that would normally be done first and that have been beneficial even beyond the time period that you're talking about. Sometimes, you know, there's been some studies looking at this at 2 years later, the people who got physical therapy alone versus physical therapy plus surgery, how did they do? And there does seem to be a little bit of benefit if you just have the spinal stenosis alone and have a type of surgery that opens up that spinal stenosis in some way but does not fuse the vertebrae together. Now, there could be a reason why your surgeon looks at it, and I'm not a surgeon. I'm not an expert in this area, but they're going to look at it, and they're going to determine probably what's the best surgical technique for you individually based on what they're seeing on that MRI or CT scan or both, and then with your overall health, and to try to give you the best option there. Spinal fusion doesn't have as, in a lot of the studies that I've seen, have the best. It still may help improve the pain, but when compared to just having like a laminectomy, where they just take off a window of that bone to sort of relieve the pressure on the spinal cord and don't fuse vertebrae together, that tends to be a little bit better. And you certainly, anytime you're going to have a fusion of vertebrae together, you're going to lose a little bit of function. So the ability for you to bend in different directions is going to be a little bit limited, even with just one, you know, with one vertebrae being fused to the other.
Right. I did have a lumbar fusion about 10 years ago, the L5S1.
Gotcha. Okay.
I got two rods and four screws in my lower back.
Yeah, and previous surgeries may influence sort of what they do too, depending on what area they're planning on going in. But yeah, it's a little bit better outcome if they're just going to do the laminectomy. But if they're talking about fusing that, and laminectomy is like a little window, like you're taking, if you can, you know, think about this as like it's a rooftop that has too much stuff in the attic, and to relieve the pressure, you just take off part of the roof and it relieves the pressure there. And that works a little bit better long term for both pain and mobility in preserving that or getting some of that back than if you fused it together. But there may be other factors, particularly since you've had that surgery before, maybe in a different area or adjacent to it that may, you know, come into play. That's the kind of stuff I would ask. I just ask, okay, what are my chances, doc, of reducing pain? And what are my chances of what kind of function am I going to have with this? And I'm glad you did the physical therapy because it can be important going into the surgery. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What did you say?
Well, I was just going to say my main concern is how effective has it been. Obviously, it's a critical area you're doing surgery in.
Right.
And I got a certain amount of pain now. You know, pain pill doesn't do much good for it.
Right.
I might walk around kind of leaning over or stop and just bend over and touch my toes. It's better for a little while, and then it's back again. But just to give you more idea, I slept in a recliner for the month of March, and I'm back I'm on the sofa now. I can't get on a flatter surface like our bed, which is kind of firm. We don't sleep on the bed yet.
Yeah, if you're having that much limitation in what you can do because of pain, I would consider it because you've done the other things. The other thing, you know, if you hadn't done the other things, I would say absolutely physical therapy at least 6 weeks, maybe longer, because that is the first line. And oftentimes for a lot of people, they'll get as good a recovery of function and decrease in pain with just physical therapy compared to surgery. I don't know of an orthopedic surgeon really that's going to jump into surgery unless you had acute paralysis. I mean, most of them are going to be like, hey, we want you to do this first, and there's great reasons for that. And you do better if you do have surgery, if you've had physical therapy first. The epidurals can sometimes help, but it's really not treating the problem. It's just treating the pain to just decrease the pain long enough so that you can move around. And then medications, too, same kind of thing. Sometimes they can work. Some things like gabapentin can buy you some time. But if you're limited in the way that you are, that you just described, I think that's a benefit that you're probably going to get. But again, depending on, I don't know the exact type of surgery that they're talking about, but that's what I would ask them. And it is variable with pain. You're not going to get a definitive, oh, absolutely, this will decrease your pain, because that's just not the case. But in situations where you do have spinal stenosis, not a pinched nerve, but the actual spinal stenosis, because I know some other listeners may be hearing this a little bit differently, then that having surgery for that is a lot more successful than, say, you know, having a disc surgery or a fusion of vertebrae because of a disc pushing on a nerve.
Right. I've just been skeptical. I mean, I know it's a risky, it's a very sensitive area, I guess.
It is. You're right about that. Now, they do have less invasive techniques in doing the surgery. So you may have seen, you know, or heard some surgeons talk about minimally invasive back surgery. And again, I don't know. It's probably going to be a little bit more complicated because you've had a previous back surgery. They're certainly not similar to like 20 years ago. There were much wider incisions, a lot more scar tissue that formed. They've got better techniques and better ways of doing the surgery so that sometimes they only have about an inch or two as an incision, and they do less damage. So that's the kind of stuff I'd be asking too, is like, what do they think? Now, again, having a previous surgery, so all bets are off. Sometimes you just don't find out till you get in there what that scar tissue looks like, because it doesn't pick up very well on the MRI scans.
All right. Okay, well, you pretty much answered my question. I appreciate the help.
All right, Lee, good luck to you. I hope you get whatever direction you go in, you get a good response from that. This is Southern Remedy. Got about a minute left, so I'm going to close out the program. And again, I just feel impressed. I usually share some things from the week, the prior week that I've had with my patients. And again, if you're going through depression, that's something that or you feel like you're depressed, don't be intimidated by asking your physician about that, because they can help. And it may not be medication that you have to take. It may be some other things that they can suggest that would improve your overall mental health. And again, having all the support systems, particularly the social interactions, is extremely important regaining that and feeling better about where you are right now. So I would really encourage you to do that, no matter what age you are. There's still a lot of stigmas out there with mental health issues, but depression is very common, and it is definitely treatable. The Southern Remedy is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio and is funded in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, professor of internal medicine and pediatrics at UMMC. Southern Remedy is produced by Kevin Farrell. You can tune in to MPB Think Radio every weekday morning at 11 for the full Southern Remedy lineup.